one of the things I will notice a note about this administration that's really great is I don't find massive impact of lobbying, and I think there is willingness to touch sacred cows.
I'm Dan Diamond. This is Pulse Check, and that was Adam Bowler, who led the CMS Innovation Center before stepping away for a new role in international development this week. The Innovation Center was created by the Affordable Care Act, funded with an initial $10 billion stake, and set up as a way to speed reforms into the health system without having to wait on Congress.
Through the law's newly established CMS Innovation Center, we have both the authority and the resources to take bold, innovative steps right now.
The idea was that Medicare could be a laboratory for changes to make healthcare more efficient and higher quality. Here was President Obama right before he left office in 2017.
We're trying to use Medicare as a lever to get better deals for consumers and better prices for consumers, not just those in Medicare, but also people throughout the system.
And Bowler, at the time a 38-year-old entrepreneur who'd founded three healthcare companies, was tapped by the Trump administration as the new leader of the center, a job that Bowler wasn't initially sure he even wanted to do.
And I called Ezra and I said, yeah, I'm not going to take this role. And Patrick's main thing to me is, can you just come and can you meet Administrator Verma?
Bowler's tenure was marked by highs like pushing changes to primary care and devising a model to improve kidney care, which President Trump touted this summer.
In a few moments, I'll sign an executive order taking vital steps to increase the supply of kidney-available transplants.
But Bowler's agency also was criticized by Democrats and Republicans for being unaccountable, not transparent, and moving too quickly. On today's show, we'll try and unpack Bowler's tenure running the Innovation Center, what he learned before taking a job as the first CEO of the U.S. International Development Finance Corporation, and how that's changed his perspective on healthcare. That conversation starts now. And let's get started. Adam Bowler, welcome to Politico Pulse Check.
Thank you, Dan, for having me.
It was your last morning in charge of the CMS Innovation Center, your first afternoon here in your new role, this new office on New York Avenue. You just walked in, is my understanding.
That's correct.
We're conceiving of this as an exit interview. We're recording this on Tuesday. It's the fiscal new year. It's the Jewish new year. You have a new job. We're kind of all the new things at once. It's also the ritual casting off of sins, I believe, in the Jewish calendar. Do you have any sins that you'd like to cast off from your time at CMS?
Not that I can think of up front. I think anyway that, you know, that's more next week.
you might know better than me. I'm a pagan. You started at CMS Innovation Center in April 2018. Spent about 18 months there. Is that the right length of time in government to get something done?
I don't know that there's a particular time, but I do feel like we accomplished a massive amount in that time. It wasn't something, you know, coming into government, you always have the question. I've only been in private business before, and you always have the question of kind of what will you be able to accomplish? You know, will it be too bureaucratic? But ultimately, I thought we were super productive. I think we put out 16 models during that 18-month period.
And these are the models that the Innovation Center develops to change payment for things like kidney care,
exactly,
or how emergency care is handled.
Exactly. You know, our mandate really is to do demonstrations to lower costs and improve quality. And so, yeah, our models were around kidney care, primary care, how we take care of seriously ill people, what we do on drug pricing. So these are just some of the issues that we focused on.
The models that are still in development, did you think you'd be able to see a few more out before taking on this new role?
I think my confirmation went a little bit quicker than I had thought or that I could have hoped. I mean, that was a really positive thing in terms of having bipartisan support in Congress. So the process was great. It was a little bit earlier than I thought, by a few weeks. That said, you know, given the time in the process, you have plenty of time to plan, plenty of time to think about what is going to exist after you and how do you ensure continuity?
You're someone who has started multiple companies. You're a serial entrepreneur, Now you're in your second role in government in 18 months. Are you someone who just needs a change every so often?
I would say, you know, it's plausible for me every 4 or 5 years. I think it's always interesting to throw yourself into something. There is an interesting intellectual challenge and expansion. It's something I recommend to people sometimes, is not to get too stuck in a role. Now, some roles offer you fantastic growth. So I think for me, that's kind of an orientation. It hasn't been 18 months generally, but I say 4 or 5 years is common.
You've talked in the past about being recruited to lead the CMS Innovation Center. Patrick Conway, your predecessor, gave you a call. You've said that you told him no, but I've never heard the rest of the story. Did Patrick mount a campaign? Was there a light bulb moment where you're like, actually, I do want to do this?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. So what happened right after I got the call from Patrick, I called, so the co-president of Francisco Partners, who was my private equity firm, his name's Ezra Perlman, and I called Ezra and I said, yeah, I'm not going to take this role. And Patrick's main thing to me is, can you just come and can you meet Administrator Verma? You know, no strings attached.
Just come listen. For a meeting.
Yeah, just come for a meeting and just listen. So I called Ezra and I said, you know, I'm going to take this meeting. I'm not going to take the role. But, you know, I not a horrible thing to do anyway. And so I flew down. And the long story short there is, you know, there's a lot of ways. And when I started Landmark, there's a lot of ways and easier ways to make money than starting Landmark, quite frankly. Like, it's a physician-run business. If that's your main goal, I think there's other things you can do. If your main goal is to create a business that makes money by doing good and creating value and having something significant, it's a fantastic business.
And Landmark targeted the sickest patients, the 5%, 10% of patients who are the most frail, who need the most services.
Yeah, and we became the biggest 24/7 home physician business in the country. And we did it because we were not just paid fee for service. We took full accountability for patients, which means you're doing everything you need to keep people healthy at home. That was our business model. So by very virtue, the way we made money was by doing right. And when you align those things, it's so significant. So the reason CMMI appealed to me is I had done a lot of thinking about what's wrong with our healthcare system today. And I'll tell you, when you pay people for more and you pay people for volume, you're going to get more and you're going to get volume. If you want people to do the right thing, we talked about kidney care a moment ago. If you want to know why we're the lowest or one of the lowest developed countries in the world on dialysis in the home, it's because we pay people to put people in kidney care facilities, in dialysis facilities, in physical facilities. That's why that happens. If you pay for the right answer, you're going to get the right answer. So that was my background. And when I sat with Patrick and when I sat with Seema and we started discussing the platform that CMMI is, that's when it was so appealing. And that's what led me to public service. I never thought I would do that until we started having those conversations.
So this is late 2017. And then you have to figure out how to extricate yourself from Landmark to get into the government.
And that took 9 or 10 months. I mean, I had to sell, you know, and I had founded another business that I was chairman of too, called Avalon. We had hire investment bankers for that. Landmark had to go through a whole process. And, you know, talk about a gut-wrenching decision too. You know, I just walked away this morning from my close to 600 people at CMMI. And we had an all staff. And those are really hard things because you work with people and you care about people. And, you know, what made it okay at CMMI to hear is if your values are the same, right? So why did I leave to go here?
That might be one of my next questions. If it's hard to walk away and you're doing this thing, transforming the U.S. healthcare system, why leave that job after only 18 months?
Because you believe in an opportunity. When I think about what we believe at CMMI, we believe in using changing incentives and payment to make the world better, to make the United States healthcare system better. This is the same thing.
This new role in international
development. It's how do you align so that we're going to make a difference in the world by incentivizing the right thing. And so that's what you're focused on. And I think at Landmark, when I left, that's how I explained it to my team. I think it would have been really hard if I had said, hey, my baby, the company I founded, and all of you, over 1,000 people, we believe so much in what we're doing. And by the way, I'm leaving and I'm going to go work for, you know, an insurance company. I don't know how that would have been taken. It would have been a very, very difficult conversation. But everybody understood because of the common values we have. And at CMMI, It was a very difficult conversation, but people understand why, because they're a common series of values.
In thinking about your successor and who you've been recruiting, did you use the same strategy that was used on you? Just come take a meeting?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I believe it's very important. Obviously, there's the policies that you establish when you're there. And so there's policy, there's building your team and growing them. Just as important and not as focused on as who comes next.
Who does come next?
Well, that's not public yet.
But you do know. Yeah.
I will say, for the record, that the individual that we're looking at hasn't finished FBI checks, ethics, which is one of the reasons, still couldn't be. But I
will say for Politico readers, we have found two names, Brad Smith and Gaurav Dayal, who were finalists for the role. Now, I'm studying Adam's face as I say that. It's a bit of a poker face, but the expectation is that one of the two men was tapped.
I will say on the successor side, I mean, not commenting on who, what was important to me, to the secretary, to Seema, I mean, my job is giving advice on this stuff, but is continuity. We've been doing wonderful things. How do you continue what we're doing? And how do you ensure that, and this is one of the best things about the Innovation Center, it's one of the best things about DFC, you have a bipartisan agency that everybody can agree on. You know, independent of whatever healthcare system we're in, the need to lower costs while improving quality is consistent. And I wanted to ensure that whoever is there believes in that and believes in keeping that center. And one of the things I'd say is, and I've noticed this, Republican, Democrat, et cetera, the amount of outpouring of support to take this role. I mean, I had, when you leave a company and you make the decision, I wanted to talk to a lot of people. You want to hear the case to do it and the case not to. And I spoke to a few folks that are not fans of this administration, but they universally told me I had to take the role because they believe in what we do here. And so that's what I like about this is it's going to survive any kind of administration.
It might not survive a lawsuit that's trying to strike down the Affordable Care Act, which created the Innovation Center, which the Trump administration is backing.
Well, you know, the one thing I'd say, no matter what happens in any of this is if ACA or not, right? It just doesn't go away overnight. And I'll say, this administration has indicated commitment to a lot of things, ACA or not. I'll give you an example, pre-existing conditions, right? I mean, I think the administration is very clear we need to orient and support pre-existing conditions.
You don't work in the healthcare department anymore, so you don't have to parrot that line if you don't want to. But the center created by the ACA, it would take an act of Congress, is my understanding, to create the center again if the ACA was struck down. We have not seen a lot of bipartisan movement on big healthcare efforts in Congress. So I think I take your point. If an appeals court decides that part or all of the ACA should fall, things might not change overnight. But if the law goes away, there's no guarantee that things like CMMI will come back.
Yeah, I mean, look, in Washington, as you know, there's not a guarantee of anything. And what I look to is where there's agreement and bipartisan support. And, sort of what I said earlier applies. I don't care what administration, everybody can agree that we need to lower healthcare costs and improve quality. And so I think you would find that support from Republicans and from Democrats.
One or two more questions about your role at CMMI before we talk about the work itself. You reported to CMS Chief Seema Verma. You've referenced her a few times, but you also had another relationship where you were Cabinet Secretary Azar, Alex Azar, his senior advisor for payment reform and transformation, essentially, or I can't remember the exact title, value-based care transformation. How important is it for your successor to have that same dual reporting structure to get things done?
I think it worked well. I think that, one of the things, so when I think about the CMMI role, it's focused on demonstration models, right, where you can lower costs and improve quality. But the right way to think about things is what should we do broadly? What should we do across different agencies in HHS, whether it's, NIH, CDC, FDA? And what should we do with Congress? Are there legislative strategies that we should approach? And when you're just looking at the demonstration model side, then you're always going to approach it with a demonstration model in view. Instead of saying, well, we have a problem. What are all the tools that we can use to address that? And so the two roles are very symbiotic, and it does give you a broader view. And so sometimes a model demonstration is appropriate. Sometimes there are other things that are appropriate too.
Did you always agree with Seema and Secretary Azar? Did you disagree 20% of the time and have to triangulate?
I have to say, from a policy perspective, I'm not sure I have had any policy disagreement in what I do in the value-based care side with the administrator or with the secretary. It doesn't mean, at the end of the day, I mean, it doesn't mean we don't debate things. It doesn't mean there aren't point of views that are reconciled.
What's
that are
something
good
you debated?
Oh, just approach to things. I mean, there's a million, you know, when you're thinking and, you know, let's say we're thinking about kidney care. Okay, well, what is the right, you know, where should the country be there, right? And part of that is opinion, but a lot of that is bringing data in, right? So our ASPE brought in a report on, you know, where are developed countries and where can we be? And we wanted to hear
ASPE, the planning arm of
yeah,
HHS,
so they'll bring data in. And so, you know, not, you know, disagreements where you're arguing, but bringing in data and saying, okay, where should we be policy-wise? So the healthy kind.
You mentioned the reaction you got from folks outside of government who said, look, we might not agree with the Trump administration. You have to take this job. I'm curious about the reaction you experienced when you started. You came into CMMI. You're younger than some of your top deputies. You have mentioned your experience in the private sector. A lot of people you worked with are career government staff or spent the bulk of their time there. And when you started in early 2018, the Trump administration had spent a year with Republicans trying to repeal the ACA that created the Innovation Center. So how did you seek to build trust with folks who, frankly, had reason to distrust you?
I think the first thing you do, and I'll do it here too, is you meet with folks, you know, you have an all hand, and you talk about what you stand for. Why am I here? Why did I take this role? And if you're aligned with the reason they took the role, then you're going to have that support. And so, I mean, my staff today, they said, you know, what advice would you give to somebody coming into CMMI? And I really think I have two really important roles. The first, and this is critical, is with them. It's listening, it's empowering your staff, it's being transparent, having honest conversations with them, supporting them. If you don't have your staff, then you're not going to accomplish much. And then your second role is external, it's relationships. And that's relationships within the administration to get things done. We have a clearance process we go through. And so you need relationships so that you can make sure that goes through successfully. Relationships with Congress, relationships with stakeholders, relationships with PTAC. You know, so those things are critically important too. And so those, but you know, you tell people what you're about and what makes you tick. And if you're genuine, then people are attracted to that.
Thinking about the nuts and bolts of what you did day-to-day running CMS Innovation Center, your job essentially fix healthcare through these different payment models. How do you go about weighing the different ideas? And you've talked a little bit about collecting them and hearing from the advisors, but like, just walk me through a sample episode if you want it to be the kidney model or maybe something that hasn't gotten as much attention.
So what you do generally, and it's an interesting question because the one thing you're not going to have, the prioritization element is critical because everybody wants to talk to you and everybody has ideas. And a lot of them are really great ideas. So how do you do it? And what we developed is a really simple matrix, actually, which is what is going to make the biggest difference from a cost perspective if you rolled it across the United States? What's going to make the biggest difference from a quality perspective? And then kind of a level of ease to accomplish, if you will, one way or the other. So how likely were we going, you know, if something was totally new payment system that really would take us 2 years, is that juice worth the squeeze? And so it's a prioritization exercise.
And is that rank ordered? So first cost, then quality, then ease?
No. The cost quality dimensions are very much, I wouldn't say, it's not like it spits out a score. But when you look at some of the stuff, I mean, we have a whole initiative right now on sepsis. And sepsis is a high coster, but I'll tell you, if you rank ordered unnecessary and avoidable deaths, sepsis is number one.
Blood poisoning, which often happens in the hospital.
Yes. And so you have people, and this is a predictable thing. This is a situation where people are coming out of the hospital and then will get infections. And people don't think, you know, you always think of infections as, oh, you know, no big deal, you know, take some antibiotics. But they are, I mean, they kill hundreds of thousands of people every single year, a much bigger avoidable cause of death than cancer, than AIDS, than, you know, so a number of these things. And so that's why it's a huge priority. It's not about cost in that case. And so I think you look at both facets and then you prioritize that way.
And this is a multi-month process.
It's a multi-month and it's an ongoing process. Because, you know, you need to do your strategic planning up front, you need to spend time. But there are things, look, you're never closed for business on this stuff. And so, you know, look, PTAC is active evaluating models right now. So if PTAC brings us something or an idea or a kernel, we don't have all the answers. I mean, our job, you know, we're the government. I'm not going to say that we know everything by any means. And so our job is to be out there with private market, to be out there with PTAC, to be out and gathering ideas and constantly running it across that filter. You don't want to be, you know, you don't just put your feet in the ground and that's it.
You sped up the pace of the Innovation Center. My colleague Rachel Rubin and I reported on how you rolled out new models faster than your predecessor. And you're talking about something like changing how kidney care is delivered or improving sepsis. Those aren't necessarily things that you can do in a 2-month strategy session in a boardroom. You do need some time. What is the minimum amount of time that you can't go below, where you really do need to kick it around with your team, with lawyers, make sure that Medicare beneficiaries are going to be protected? Because not everything in the government can be like Silicon Valley.
100%. I mean, it's funny because I got a question from my team actually this morning also. Somebody said, tell us what you think about the clearance process. You know, and the clearance process for your listeners are whenever we do something, not only do we have to go through a whole CMMI process, we go through a CMS process, an HHS process, an OGC, which is our legal process. Then it goes to the Office of Management and Budget, the National Economic Council.
I would just add, as a reporter, sometimes the clearance process is when things start to get surfaced to the media because so many different pairs of eyes are now looking at it.
So you love the clearance process.
Yeah, the longer the clearance process, the better. Really just CC Politico next time. It'll make it a little faster.
So, you know, that process, they asked me about it. And look, I mean, as somebody that likes to get things done, you know, your first reaction sometimes is, oh, I don't like that. But here's what I'd say is it serves a very important purpose, which is as you go through those layers, there are checks and balances. And those checks and balances are very important. And so there's no model that doesn't go through a very rigorous, both internal at CMMI, but then a very significant check and balance. And I will say that through that process, the models become better. So there's always that that you're looking at. So it's many months. I mean, there's no question it's many months. And the other thing I'll say about the clearance process, too, is what would you expect, right? I mean, I don't view it as overdoing because they're important sweeping models, right? As you mentioned, we're talking about kidney care here. If we're talking about a mandatory model, right, we've committed to going to notice and comment.
This is mandating that providers might do something, which is a little different
Different than a voluntary model, right? So voluntary model, we're going to take massive input, right? Heavy stakeholder input. We're going to, you know, have discussions with Congress. We're going to, you know, so it's going to broad and then it goes through our whole clearance. And then at the end of the day, if somebody doesn't want to do a voluntary model, they don't. Nothing's forcing them. If you're doing a mandatory model, I think you've got to view it like a rule. And so you go through notice and comment, and there's a formal opportunity to get input, which is what we've done on, you know, the drug model, et cetera, some of these mandatory models. They're important models, but it's, you know, you've got to have that formal ability to get feedback.
There are about 600 staff at the Innovation Center. They are conceiving of these new models. They're rolling them out. But then there's the question of standing them up. The number of staff, my understanding, hasn't changed, and yet you've sped up the pace and there are more models out there than before. I've heard from some folks inside that they're feeling the pinch. Does CMMI, does the Innovation Center, need more resources to make these models successful long-term?
You're never going to ask somebody that runs an agency whether they need more resources, and they're going to say
But you're not running it anymore, so you can be honest.
No, I, The answer here, so you are going to see in the very near term, and we've been public about this, a lot of the requests for application or RFAs come out. So there's a lot of detail. They've just been going through our clearance process, but they're in a great place. And so, you know, the next step here is getting applications, vetting them, and then rolling out the models. The nice thing is the policy is done once we release the RFA. And so people have very good clarity in the near term. And so, well, I have full confidence in the Innovation Center in terms of operationally rolling out. The other thing we've done on a lot of our models, like when I think about some of the priorities we've had, one of the priority for me was how do you take CMMI from, you know, appropriately so as a startup, testing a whole bunch to make it scalable. And so when you see our new models, they are built on, you know, kind of a common chassis. It's a chassis that, you know, you'll see that there's some common elements that come through. And the reason we do that is because I believe if people are going to participate in our models, and we're going to require accountability, they're going to need predictability and simplicity and approach. And so you'll see that filter through. And that also helps, right? Because once you've built on this kind of common area, you're able to introduce more flavors to it instead of 40 different kinds of models. So I think that's important.
The CMS Innovation Center, as we've amply discussed, is this powerful vehicle to change the healthcare system. And Democrats and Republicans have taken turns either praising or criticizing the Innovation Center as wonderful or too powerful. I want to give you a binary choice. I'm not looking for a middle option, so one or the other. Is the Innovation Center too powerful or not powerful enough?
I think that the Innovation Center is just right. It's a tie.
This isn't Goldilocks.
Everybody ties. Yeah. Everybody wins. Look, I think at the end of the day, the root of that question in my mind is if you are going through the appropriate processes, then, as I said, that is getting the right stakeholder feedback and in a mandatory model, going through appropriate notice and comment, then I don't think it's a question of whether you're too powerful if you do things the right way.
Let's spend a little bit more time on the models. The kidney model got the most bipartisan acclaim. Is there a model that you think should have gotten more attention, more health industry support, and when you rolled it out, you were surprised by the reaction?
The kidney care model, I think, obviously got a lot of attention because the president rolled it out. And what I'm proud about in kidney care, it's what I'm proud about on the drug side too, is I think it represents an effort by CMMI to touch places that other people haven't. Those are big lobbies, and they're big problems.
You're talking about in the kidney world, there are basically two big companies that control dialysis centers. So patients have to go to these centers. They've got kidney disease. It's expensive. It's seen as archaic. What you try to do as part of a bigger effort, shift care from these centers to at home, there's evidence that not only is it more cost effective, higher quality too.
That and add in transplant. I mean, right now you have a situation where there are many organs available that aren't used, and that's the best option. And one thing I'm proud about, I mean, you're mentioning some of the dialysis companies. We could have taken a tact, and this is never, my tact on this is we set the incentives, as I mentioned. If we're going to pay a certain way, then we should expect a certain behavioral response. So what we did in these kidney care models is we sat down with stakeholders, and we said, look, how could we shift this in the right way so that you do the right thing? And the feedback was overwhelming. I mean, it wasn't against the industry in this case, actually. We worked with them. And that's not because we were forced to. Because one of the things I will notice a note about this administration that's really great is I don't find massive impact of lobbying. And I think there is willingness to touch sacred cows. We did that because that's the right way to influence it. And so I'm proud about that in kidney. I'm proud about our primary care efforts. You know, our efforts in primary care, you look at how physicians are paid right now, and they're going to do 20, 30 visits a day. That's how they have to make a living. I mean, my father is a primary care physician. He worked real hard when I was young, and he wasn't making that much. So our efforts to say, listen, be paid whether you're keeping people healthy at home. That's the right way to do it. Let's empower you. You're a physician. I want to take away regulation. Me as the government telling what? I didn't go to medical school. So those efforts, I think they'll be very broad and very felt. Some of our efforts working with seriously ill patients, again, it's a place, these are difficult issues. And so you can decide to shy away from them. But I think what my team at the Innovation Center did is they said, no, let's hit them head on.
Is the kidney model the capstone in your mind of everything you did at CMMI, yes or no?
I think the kidney model is one among many. It fits into a broader theme of completely shifting our system from fee-for-service to outcome-based.
I like that you also answered my question about which model didn't get the best reception by going to one that did. Was there one that you felt like rolled out and the industry made a loud noise and said, we're not down with this idea from the Innovation Center?
I'm hesitating, quite frankly, not really, because by the time we introduce a model, we've had so much stakeholder feedback that I generally know reaction. Look, the press and the focus on kidney was overwhelming. But again, you know, some of the ways that I mark these things, and I'll give you an example, direct contracting. And, you know, for your listeners, direct contracting is basically saying, look, sophisticated physician groups, we're going to move accountability from a central level and empower local physician groups. So you're going to take accountability for this patient set. It's basically taking away fee for service. And again, just numbers by way of example. One of our first tests of that was NextGen ACO, which was launched a number of years ago. And we have a process. We get LOIs.
And letters of intent.
Letters of intent. It's the first step of the process. Not everybody that gets an LOI goes forward. But just for comparison purposes, I believe we got 38 LOIs for NextGen when we introduced it, of which that yielded roughly half the amount of NextGen, so 19 or something like that. We got 1,050 LOIs for DC. So when I started, people said, is value-based care going to happen? And what's that? DC and primary care first will start in 2021. Kidney care too. You will see a massive sea change. And maybe people won't know it was us by that time, right? Things will have moved on, but that's okay. I think you will see a massive sea change in American healthcare from these. I mean, 1,050 LOIs, that's over half the country.
The administrator has talked about the rural health plan that's underway. This has been a big focus. My folks had told me this was something you were helping steer. Now you're not there anymore. What is so exciting about the rural health effort that is coming soon?
When we introduce these models, we've got to find a way to make them inclusive for everybody. And so I don't want to just focus on the 85% of the country that's in suburban and urban areas. And so we've had a lot of feedback on the rural side. And the models, what we need to do, if you're going to transform, we've asked people, you know, how do you get from A to B? So think about a rural community now. How do we orient and leverage telemedicine more? How do we take beds that may or may not be necessary, convert them to behavioral beds? How do we leverage a hub and spoke model where people are leveraging a Walmart to deliver care? The VA just introduced something really cool there. So how can we change? And what we've heard from rural health folks is we want to transform, but it just can't happen overnight. We're the major employer in our community, and we have no resources. And so what we're planning to do there is by measuring very effectively on a plan that they give us with objective outcomes, we're going to give them that opportunity to transform. And I think it will be massively impactful for our rural patients everywhere.
And the goal is to also empower communities to make decisions, not have the federal government mandate.
100%. I mean, I'm a big believer. I mean, the tough thing, when you're trying to manage the United States, I mean, think of how different, you know, Alaska is from New York, from, you know, Florida, and then compare it, let's use an individual state, Columbus, Ohio, Cincinnati, rural Ohio. I mean, what huge differences? How could we possibly manage that? Our job is to empower the people that know how to take care of people, their providers, their communities. I want those closest to the patient to make those decisions. And our job as the government is to set the stage, right? It's to ensure patients are protected, that there's not fraud, that we're focused on public health initiatives like opioid crisis, other things like that. Our job isn't to make medical decisions or make it difficult to take care of people. So you will see that sea change because that's what we believe.
Is this new job a plan to move out of healthcare long term?
No, not necessarily. In fact, I mean, I think that one of the things that DFC can do is focus on global healthcare too. I mean, it's a key area in developing economies. And so, no, I think what you would see is consistent in my career is trying to align incentives to make a big difference, and that's consistent. And so whether it was healthcare or not, I'd say there's consistency there.
Last question. You've made a ton of money in the private sector. You've held one high-level government job. You've just started a second. By all accounts, you have a lovely family, a wife, four kids. You just turned 40. Honestly, is there anything left to do?
Well, thank you.
What's your bucket list at this point?
Look, the reason I'm doing public service is to make, it's to make a big impact, and I'll continue to kind of follow where that goes. I guess from my perspective, in any role that I'm going, I try not to spend time thinking about what the next is. I never would have guessed when I was at Landmark that I would be at CMMI. I never would have guessed coming from CMMI into DFC. So you keep a common set of what binds you, values and principles, and you kind of follow that. And I think it takes you to great places.
Adam Bowler, the former head of the CMS Innovation Center, thank you for joining Politico Pulse Check.
Thank you, Dan. Sorry, was I too boring?
That's it for Pulse Check this week. My thanks to Adam Bowler and his colleagues at the Overseas Private Investment Corporation who helped make this conversation possible, and to Annie Reese for producing the show. If you like Politico Pulse Check, you can find us on all of your favorite podcast apps. Just search for Politico Pulse Check. You can find me at ddiamond@politico.com with suggestions for upcoming shows. You'll find a new episode of Pulse Check in your podcast player very soon, and thanks for listening.